part of the larger story of the logistics problem involved the use of barges, not only on the Tennessee and Mississippi rivers, but also through the Gulf of Mexico, Panama Canal, and up in the Pacific side from California. And to get that story, Carl Dineen suggested that we talk to the head of the NASA fleet, as he called it, a man named Carl Poole. And Mr. Poole turned out to be an intriguing character. Dineen described him as an old Navy bosun, and Mr. Poole certainly was. It had the look of an old Navy hand. He had a gorgeous tattoo, a very large tattoo on his forearm. He had also an appropriate bay window, which is not to denigrate him in any way, but it was just a very interesting character, kind of a very interesting figure. So we picked up Poole at the headquarters area, and John Belt was along. We drove his car down to the docks on the Tennessee River, where the three barges then in port were tied up. Poole was going to use the government car, although his own car was out there. He wanted to use the government car. He was having trouble getting a hold of the keys, so John volunteered to take his own car, use his own gas. Mr. Poole obligingly agreed. On the way down to the docks, Poole made some comments about the barges used in the Saturn program. They were the YFNB class, developed during the Second World War as a floating supply, repair, maintenance areas, or bases and forward areas in the Pacific. They were self-contained. They were not self-propelled, but they were self-contained. They had their own power supplies, a complete galley, very large work areas and storage areas, keeping supplies, making these repairs to keep the fleet going in support of the military effort in World War II. The three barges are tied up at the end of a very large, broad highway that runs all the way through the Marshall Space Flight Center complex, through some of the Army test areas, down to the dockside. The road was built especially to carry the various Saturn stages, the test assembly areas when they were manufactured at Marshall, down to the docks for loading aboard the barges, where they were carried either to Cape Kennedy or, in some instances, to the Mississippi Test Facility for further testing. Three barges in port at the time. As we faced them, on our left was the Lehman. In the center was the Orion, the largest of the three barges. And on the right, as we looked at them, was the barge Promise. These barges, as I understood it, as Carl Poole talked to us, each carried normally about a 12-man contingent. There was a 5-man marine crew to see about the handling and running of the barge itself. There was a 6-man stage crew who were aboard to make sure that the stages arrived and were cared for properly en route to their destination. And there was one government observer. And as I understood it, the government observer was there to, as the final arbiter, to make decisions when decisions were necessary, perhaps if the Marine crew disagreed with the stage crew, and also just as an observer. For loading the barges, there were two different methods. For the Palamon and the Promise, the procedure was to ballast the barge so that it sank down in the water to a point where its edge was about 8 inches above the lip or the edge of the dock. And then a sort of plank or platform was installed from the dock to the edge of the barge. And as the stage was rolled on, the weight of the stage itself would help bring the barge down to the level of the dock for easy loading. This was done with the Palamon and the Promise, which carried the first S1s, in the first S-1B stages. The Orion was constructed especially to carry the S-1C stages. And in the case of the Orion, the edge of the barge was kind of stepped. It butted right into the edge of the dock and rested very firmly on a little ledge stepped into the dock, using approximately 500 tons of ballast to snug the barge in. We first went aboard the Promise, and one of the things that struck you immediately, and which Poole pointed out to us, were the reinforcement strips or aprons that ran up the length of the deck, one on each side. And these were to take the weight of the tires of the transporter as the whole thing with the loaded stage was rolled aboard. It was interesting to see then that this was a necessary step to take to beef up the basic structure of the barge. There were a series of tie downs at each wheel, what he called an 8-point tie down system. By each wheel were 2 points, and then the thing was secured at the top and down on the other side at 2 other points. So by each wheel, there were 2 tie-down points, making a total of 8 in all. The barge was equipped with dehumidifiers, 2 on the port side, 2 on the starboard. There was considerable room beneath the decks in the original ship for storage. The original YFNB was about 24 feet in depth, 2 separate decks then, 12 feet each. To carry the stages, they used the lower deck. They were still 12 feet below the lower deck, 12 feet then to the gunwale. But then, of course, a huge overstructure had been prepared to take the stage as it was rolled aboard. The NASA organization kept the barges as completely self-sufficient transportation vehicles. Each barge had a power plant to run its air conditioning, to provide power for lights, provide power for the water systems, plumbing systems, for the machine shops, kitchens, the general electronic gear needed to keep the barge in running order. The Promise in particular was a floating repair ship for the Navy after World War II, based in Florida. It came into the NASA fleet as a result of a collapse of a lock in Wheeler Dam in the Tennessee River. And one of the stages was on its way down at the time, and the lock had collapsed, stranding the barge and its cargo upstream. And so another barge was brought up to meet it, known as the Compromise. The stage was unloaded, a special road had to be built around the damaged lock, was reloaded aboard the Compromise, and the voyage continued. Later on, it was felt that the Compromise was not really an appropriate name for NASA, and so the COM was dropped, and the Compromise simply became the barge Promise. The various YFNB barges acquired by NASA were largely in the Navy's mothball fleet. The Promise in particular was a good example of its emergency requisition. There was very much a look of the carpenter about it. It was much rougher in feeling. Going aboard a barge or a seagoing vessel, one would expect to see more metal bulkheads, metal equipment, welding, things of this type, riveting. But the Promise was definitely had a kind of almost a shack-like atmosphere about it. It was obvious that the people who had converted its various areas into bunk areas, crew areas, had simply gone in and put up plywood partitions in the easiest manner, easiest mode possible. It was livable. There wasn't anything particularly wrong with it. It just had this definitely rougher look about it. One of the structures in one of the large work areas that we saw had been originally used as a radio, a repair shack, kind of inside the barge. And the exterior of this room appeared to be just regular housing siding. The kind of thing you'd find on a normal, ordinary home. And the effect, I must say, was rather incongruous. The air conditioning unit was just hung from the ceiling at that time. It was leaking very badly, and there was a jerry-rigged catch-all to catch the runoff. It just had a very rough, different, compromised look about it. In the early days of the barge operations, according to Poole, a lot of top management kind of liked the idea of riding along. It was sort of novel, especially the voyage down the California coast, the Panama Canal, and the Gulf. Carl Heinberg, he said, was one who made the trip a couple of times. Van der Zee was another. There were slightly larger bunk areas then for the VIPs from NASA who might have wanted to make a barge trip. We passed into the galley area, which was a very interesting thing. Again, it had a kind of a rough look about it, a compromised look, and confirming my stereotypes about Navy galleys, there were a couple of very luscious, girly calendars hanging on the walls. The galley was fairly well equipped with large stoves, fairly large refrigerators, and of course the usual complement, tables, chairs, sinks, things of this type. The power for the compromise was a Caterpillar diesel engine, AC, 60 kilowatts. Nearby was a repair room, a lathe, welding equipment, a drill press, what appeared to be at one time a rather complete tool area. Again, fulfilling this self-sustaining, self-contained philosophy with enough tools and machinery on board ship to make emergency repairs, keep underway, and do whatever was necessary. We left the Promise and then went aboard the Orion, and the difference really was quite obvious. On the Promise, the outside where the huge bulbous overstructure had been added, on the outside of the vessel it was necessary to add metal V-shaped supports and metal supports on the sides. The bulbous structure overhung the original gunwales by about maybe 3 or 4 feet. So there were metal supports then that went down to other parts of the original structure. And it had the look of an American gunboat, the kind that you used to see on the Yangtze back in the 20s and 30s, kind of like a large canvas canopy aboard the thing. But the Orion was very much different. It was much slicker. And as Poole pointed out to us, it had been taken into a Navy yard, constructed, engineered from the very beginning as a barge to carry a large S1C stages. In getting the S1C aboard the Orion, the crew made use of turnbuckles to sort of winch the thing in. Then it was secured, and there were guidelines painted on the deck of the barge. It had to be aligned rather exactly, because once it was aboard, it was snugged up to an A-frame, very large, which would have to be to accommodate the S1C. The A-frame point, of course, was the center of the stage, and used not only to take the S1C, but the S2 stage. There was a handling ring built into the S2 and S1C stages, attached to the A-frame. The A-frame took the entire weight, so that literally, if the ship moved from side to side, the stage would stay in one point. The barge literally moved around the stationary stage as it was affixed to the A-frame. The equipment on the Orion included not only the dehumidifying equipment, but nitrogen, port and starboard, to keep pressure on the interior tanks of the S1C and S2 stages to keep them from collapsing. When the Orion was built, the Coast Guard was on the spot in the shipyard, although one got the impression from Poole that the barges were not entirely up to say, Coast Guard or Maritime regulations. They were enough to do the job. But maybe they weren't quite as up to snuff as they might have been. We went up into the pilot house of the Orion, and Poole emphasized, as did Carl Dineen, the role of the Meckling Barge Lines Incorporated, M-E-C-H-L-I-N-G, Meckling Barge Lines Incorporated, based in Joliet, Illinois. As we understood it, the Meckling Barge Lines were unique in the fact that they had seaway rights to go from one river into the next, into the Gulf of Mexico, into the Pacific Ocean, into the various inland channels. Apparently other barge lines don't have the rights to go into all these things. The cargo has to be transferred or even offloaded from one barge line to the next. The Meckling Line's seaway rights from port to port made it an extremely valuable asset to NASA and accounts for the large amount of business that the Meckling Barge Lines got. They made considerable use of the tugboat Carl Fuqua, F-U-Q-U-A, Fuqua as it was sometimes called. And the Fuqua was remotely equipped. In ordinary operation, the barge pushed, the tug pushed the barge from behind. And in the case of the Promise and the Palamon, control took place then from the pilot house to the tug. But in the case of the Orion, control took place from the pilot house of the barge itself. And some of the barge captains had to relearn the different kind of control that they experienced in this kind of thing. The power was supplied by the tug in the rear. The control took place forward. In case something did happen, there was an automatic remote control that switched back to the tug's pilot house so that it could be done from either place. And when the barge and tug were underway, the crew or captain, whoever was doing the piloting, would do a six-hour stint and 6 hours off. The tug captain and the pilot then alternating. The pilot house of the Orion, of course, included a full array of various electronic communications gear, since it was, in all respects, the command post whenever the barge and tug was underway with a loaded cargo. A few random bits of information. When the lock collapsed at Wheeler Dam, the Tennessee Valley Authority had the responsibility to build the roads around the lock. And it was done fairly rapidly because the NASA program, or the Saturn program at this time, had a national priority rating, so the road got built fairly fast. It not only served NASA, however, it also served the Atomic Energy Commission, which also used the Tennessee River with large, and sometimes bulky, and highly valuable cargo. Typically, the tugboats would push barges and cargoes in river areas and at sea. They would be towed. But in much of the seaborne operations of NASA, the ship used was the point barrel. The point barrel was an AKD, a Navy designation ship. It was originally pressed or used in the Navy as a dry dock ship. The aft part of the ship then was a rather hollow thing, designed to be used as a dry dock in forward areas. Point barrel actually served 5 years in Arctic duty. It could stay frozen in the ice for long periods at the time, and its cargo area, if you want to call it that, provided easy access, and it was fairly uncluttered for the stowage of materials and supplies for the Arctic party. The point barrel is now in Brooklyn in the Navy's reserve fleet. And although the Navy is responsible for its maintenance, the bill for it is still paid by the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. Whenever NASA got ready for a mission using the barges and tugs, they acquired their crews from the Mechlin Company. As I recall, there was an annual contract signed with the Mechlin Company for it to supply the required crew, whatever NASA demanded it. And usually NASA was had to give about a 2 weeks' notice to get a crew from Illinois down, get them aboard the barge, get the thing ship shape, and have also then assigned a tug and a crew for the tug to handle the necessary work. And this is the conclusion of the tape concerning the logistics interview with Carl Poole.